The world-famous Conservation Canine Camp will next be running in southeast Queensland, Australia, from the 21st to the 25th of August. Join us with your dog to start your journey into conservation detection. Visit padfoot.com.au to book your place today. Okay, everyone, welcome to a special coming up for Christmas 2022 episode of the Conservation Canine Podcast, the show that celebrates and educates dog teams protecting the natural world. With me today, I've got two very special guests. One particularly special guest because I've been trying to get her on the show for what seems like forever. And obviously the other person is on the show all the time. We just can't get rid of him. He's like a tick we can't shake off. So welcome to the show from Rogue Detection Teams, Jennifer Hartman and Heath Smith. Firstly to you, Jennifer. Hey, we got you on the show. Hi. Finally.
Yeah, no, I'm so grateful to be on it. I am kind of an obsessive listener of all of your episodes, so it's pretty cool to be on one.
Oh, that's awesome. And Heath, there you are, mate. Good to see you.
Howdy. I've been pressuring Jennifer to do this for quite a while, so I'm really, really excited to have
a chat. Yeah, and you're just going to sit there in the wings and sort of heckle and poke and prod and ask questions that I don't, right? Yeah, the really interesting things. Yeah, cool.
You bet.
Good stuff. Brace yourself, Jennifer. Here we go.
I know. I'm a little afraid now.
So we were just talking before we came on air, but like I've seen the pictures you guys have got social media up where you are in Washington State at the moment, and it looks amazing. It looks very, very Christmassy up there. So obviously field season for you guys has finished up now. So so let's start with that. How did this field season go?
Ooh, that's a big question. I think it's exciting. We had another incredibly full year, and I don't think we ever could have anticipated 3 years into developing Rogues that we would have as many projects. So I think we're really humbled that the science community, you know, wants to work with us, values the work that detection dog teams do. And it's really neat to see that more and more different researchers are considering this method. But the caveat to that is that, you know, putting teams in the field is incredibly challenging. And I think as this method is growing, we're experiencing some growing pains in terms of being able to put teams out there that we, you know, that we kind of know can do the job. And so that's actually where Rogues is right now is, are we going to downsize, keep our kind of program small just to contain kind of the quality control? Or do we want to continue to grow and bring new teams in? Because there's a lot of interest, but how do we do that? How do we do that with all the other work that we have? So we're in a bit of a transition phase right now, I'd say, kind of decide all that.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are very much victims of your own success in a good way, but it's yeah. I mean, I can't wrap my head around the fact you've only been around, you know, as Rogues for 3 years, and I think a lot of that is largely down to the work. I know you do most of it, Jennifer, in terms of the social media and so on. You know, the education and the knowledge sharing that you guys put out there on a regular basis, and just the engagement with stuff that other teams are doing around the world and so on as well. Yeah, I mean, that takes an inordinate amount of time. And yeah, I mean, I suppose that does put you in the position now where, I mean, everybody wants to come and work with Rogues.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think,
pretty much.
I think everyone wants to work in this field, and yeah, we're one of maybe, even though this field is growing, we're one of the few programs out there that has the capacity to maybe put more teams on existing projects. Because if a person is starting alone and solo, it's just overwhelming. Like, where do you start? How do you get your own work? And so going to a program is kind of one of the more straightforward ways for an individual who's interested in entering this field to have that support system. But I think Keith and I are struggling with the fact that we might not be that best of a support system, because running a program just takes so much effort that it's almost like the catch-22. You know, you want to put more teams out there to do this work because we know it works, we value it, and we love seeing it be utilized, not just with us, but with other teams around the world. Like that's always been our passion and our emphasis. But then how to kind of balance that with what we're able to give as individuals to, and and the science communication, right? That was a big part of our mission, is we didn't want to work in a kind of a silo of, you know, most of our work over the past 20 years, I mean, a fraction of it's been published. And so if we just continued to do that, no one would know about some of the amazing things that detection teams do. And so when we started Rogues, I realized I couldn't kind of keep my blinders on and pretend like, we're just out here doing this work and it's having impact. So the education part has been really important for us too. And it's, again, like just putting a lot on our plate and trying to figure out like, where do we focus? It's been tough.
It's tough though, isn't it? Because it's the same with every organization. Once you reach kind of a critical point, there's an evolution there. There's a sort of transition into roles that need happening as you're a bigger organization. There's increased admin, there's increased human resource, factors. There's all of those kind of elements that may or may not float your boat. And that becomes a challenge there, that you can sort of see the potential of and the benefits to the industry, I suppose, as a whole, of bringing on more teams and helping them develop and working on those amazing projects and that kind of thing. But somebody's got to administer and herd the cats and do all that sort of stuff. And,
we're terrible at herding cats. So
I thought Heath was a cat person.
I love cats. I wish we had cats.
Detection cats.
Detection cats would be
detection cats.
So that's our next evolution.
Yeah. If you can get a cat to do it, that'd be awesome. Not quite sure how you motivate a cat, but
ask them not to do it.
You will not go and find this really hard to find thing.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's dial back then. Let's talk about you, Jennifer, because that's what we want to talk about in this episode. So how did you kind of find yourself where you are now?
Ooh. I always talk about it as kind of an accident. And maybe that's how a lot of us find our way in this. At least back when I first started, it wasn't really a well-known thing. And so it wasn't even something I could be like, I want to pursue that. But I started out doing spotted owl research right out of college as a volunteer, as an intern. And spotted owls in North America are endangered. And there's a protocol for them where you call and they respond back. And it's been working, it's been great. But then with the incursion of an invasive species, a similar cousin that's more aggressive, this species was actually becoming more quiet. And the question was like, how can we find this endangered species on the landscape? And because I had this previous experience serving for spotted owls, and it had become a full, a job, a paid job, woohoo, in biology, which is rare. I was then asked to, would you want to, with your experience, maybe work with dogs to help find these owls that are being more quiet? And I'd heard about the dog stuff basically from Heath and the whale work. So I knew that there were dogs out there doing, looking for wildlife. And I thought it was cool, but I never, ever, ever wanted to, I never thought of myself as a dog handler or wanting to work with dogs. I always loved animals. But I always thought it was more of a passive thing. Like I would not be doing the active thing. And so I said yes to this, kind of, this job is only supposed to be 4 months. And I went to, at the time, the Conservation Canine training facility, and that's where I met a dog named Max. And he stole my heart. He stole my imagination. He gave me so much joy. I didn't even get to work with him, but just being around him, it was just something magical. Like there was just a connection. I don't know, that I would do anything to be around him. And so when the project, came to an end, and I was, I could pursue something else. I asked if I could stay on just to be near him, just to, even if I wasn't going to get to work with him, you know, cause these weren't our dogs at the time. And that's, it meant the world to me just to be around him. And so that's kind of, I think, what launched my career in this field was meeting Max. And then obviously all the other dogs after him, but when I first started, I wanted to quit the same day. I'm a quiet person, a shy person, and the dogs to me are, you know, loud and bark and crazy, and especially the dogs that we adopt. So I always felt like a fish out of the water, but Max made me feel like I belonged, and he was quiet too, and he was kind of shy and introverted too, if you could have a, you know, a dog we described that way. And so I think we, maybe we felt that's why we, you know, we bonded across the distance. And so, yeah, I stuck around to be with him. And then that meant volunteering. You know, there wasn't a lot of work back then. So it meant just kind of hanging around and being near these dogs that I didn't feel I was capable or competent enough to work with, but always being guided by Heath. And he was really positive, mentor for much of my career, and still is, encouraging me to believe in myself. And so I kind of just kept going, I guess. So here I am. It's kind of a total accident, but kind of snowballed.
Yeah, well, I mean, and we hear that a lot. I mean, a lot of people, because it's such a new field. Like, well, it isn't. It isn't arguably a new field, but. So many people have kind of fallen into it and just fallen in love with it in that way. Tell us a little bit more about Max then. So what sort of dog was he and that kind of thing?
I'll see if I can talk about him. It might be hard for me, but he was an Australian Blue Heeler, and he came from an animal shelter for cattle dogs. And he was at the program before I started. So I think he had been there, was it a year before I started? 6 months,
a bit of time.
It goes away. But by the time I met him, I think he was around 4 years old. And there's actually other people in the program, not Heath, who didn't believe in him and thought he should be, you know, returned to the shelter or adopted out, because he, as sometimes healers are, he stick close to his person. And he hadn't found his person yet either. So he had a lot of insecurities in the field in terms of maybe staying too close to the handler, not exploring. And then he also didn't want to give up the ball. And so people found it challenging to work with him. Like they didn't, he didn't endear himself to people easily, I guess, but Heath loved him. And I was actually told when I first started that, you know, not to go near Max because he was Heath's dog. And so I had that warning, but you know, you can't help who you fall in love with. He's just super quirky. He loved paper products. So I always had to keep books and toilet paper and everything away from him. He was really subtle. And he loved to what I call catalog odors in the wild. So when we were doing when we eventually got to work on spotted owls together, he would first find all the pellets and then go back and alert at the one. But if you didn't know what you were looking at, you might assume that he was ignoring the odors. And so you kind of had to give him extra time. His alert wasn't this like strong sit. He would kind of, you know, swagger and saunter over, do a little sachet of his tail and just kind of lay down. So it wasn't your lab, you know, it wasn't this like over exciting, exuberant. slobbering at the mouth. I got this. I'm so excited. He was very subtle. And I think it was hard for him to, for other people when they worked with him, to know whether or not he was working. And I don't know if this is true or not, but I like to think that because I just loved him so much and he could do no wrong in a way, that's what made us work, is that he had that like confidence basically just like flowing forth through me to him. And then he felt he could be himself and do the way he needed to work. And then we went on to find, you know, grizzly bears. We went to Cambodia together. Well, Heath actually brought him after we had a dog get sick, but he worked on tigers in Cambodia. He did spotted owl work, like I said. He loved New Stellid work, probably because I love New Stellid work. He searched for moose and caribou. He was always kind of the underdog too, like, oh, he'll be our backup dog, but we have all these other dogs. We'll just bring him in case. And then always without fail, he ended up like coming in to save the day. And I think he found the most grizzly bear samples out of the entire team of like six when we did that work. He came in and saved the day when we were in Alberta, Canada on our moose, wolf and caribou project. You know, we had a couple dogs who needed some extra rest days because it was really thick snow, speaking of snow. And we thought Max and some of our other shorter dogs wouldn't be able to survey in that depth. And he came in and saved the day when those dogs needed extra rest. And so I always think of him as kind of this like, you know, underdog. Most people won't ever read about him or know about him, but I think he was kind of, you know, my personal hero.
He sounds incredible, actually. I mean, I love that description of him because it really does highlight the importance of getting that team dynamic, you know, right between the person and the dog. You know, a lot of people, and with the greatest respect to them, but a lot of people in this field wouldn't be able to cope too well with a dog that didn't work kind of exactly within the parameters that they would wish it to work and that kind of thing. Whereas with you, you obviously were dialed up into each other and had enough empathy with each other to allow each other to work in their own way and get those results. And often I find those dogs amazing. Those bench dogs that are, yeah, they're not the reserves anymore. They're the finishers, if you know what I mean. They're the ones that kind of come in and just basically can just come in and smash anything. You know, it's but they can only do that if you've got that faith in them. So I think that's beautiful.
I think what helps though, with you saying that, and that's really interesting you bring that up, that in some ways I think what helped me is that I didn't know anything about this field and I didn't have expectations. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. And I, in some ways I was really reluctant. Like I didn't want to be a handler. I love the owl stuff because it was quiet and I could observe this owl for 18 hours and mark their, you know, their behaviors and collect their fecal. And, but I didn't ever, you know, wasn't, again, like I said, it was kind of a very passive and it was very, it's kind of how I like to experience, nature and the outdoors. And in some ways, Max was my bridge to experiencing a whole other side, you know, because dogs use their noses. And so now my world was awakened to so much more than I had ever observed before. And I didn't know I could experience, I guess, nature in that way and in what he showed me. And so I think that was the other special thing that kept me in this field even after, you know, he reached retirement and I had been working with other dogs is always that sense of discovery alongside them. And he was kind of my first cohort in that. But you were going to say something about Max and I was curious.
Oh, I was going to say he was a cat trapped in a dog's body to a certain extent. But also when, as Jennifer mentioned, Max and I were pretty close for a while. And I can remember very vividly when he kind of picked her and he just started following her everywhere she went. And I knew right then that that they would be a team and inseparable. Mm. Which is beautiful yeah. thing.
Now, it always is when you see that connection, you know, it is a beautiful thing. You've obviously worked with, you know, and partnered with a lot of dogs you know, over your career since Max? You know, was Max still the one?
He's still the one, but I have to say, I think some of the lessons I've learned from some of the other dogs that I've worked with have been, I don't know if I can say more pivotal, but like Max, it was just love, right? Like he, like I said, he could do no wrong. But with the other dogs, mostly I didn't want to work with them. And he's kind of had to be like, you're working with this dog, you're doing it. And I'm like, oh man, not again. But one dog I worked with, I remember, I think it was my second project, was Heath's dog, Allie. And she was not a dog. She was not an easy dog to work with. She was very independent. She was very fast. I was a very green handler. I knew nothing. And I just remember this one time in the field when Heath always tells us all, every bounder who comes in, like, trust the dog. And I know that's been a common theme on your podcast too, of others, sharing that same wisdom. And there was this one time in the field with Allie where we were doing Martin work and she alerted to this spot and I went to it and there was nothing there. I mean, Martin's get can be small, but it's not invisible. And I called her off, which is a big no-no. If, as anyone in this field knows, don't call your dog off an odor. But she wouldn't leave it. She was stubborn, just being herself. And, so I went back and I looked again. I'm like, there's nothing here, Allie. I don't know what you're telling me. And it was literally like that kind of a conversation. Maybe I didn't say that aloud. I can't remember anymore, but it was literally like, what are you trying to tell me here? And so I tried to call her off again. And the third time she finally left, but it was really, really like, I don't want to do this. And we were walking away or maybe 50 meters away. And I was like, something's not right. Like I did a whole bunch of things I wasn't supposed to do. I know I wasn't supposed to do them. So what is she trying to tell me? I need to figure this out. So I went back to that spot and I had her alert to it again. She went exactly to the same spot. So I'm like, there has to be something here. And I just started like brushing around the duff and the dirt. And my hand actually punched through the surface. And it looks like solid ground. But before you knew it, there was a cavity under the ground where she was. And I got on my hands and knees. I put my headlamp on and I put my hand down, you know, with the glove on. Who knows what's down there? But I pulled out a handful of mustelid scats. And I was just like, that was the first time I realized that this method works. Like, sure, I had been working with dogs before and I kind of took for granted, like, yeah, dogs find data. That's what we're teaching them. But this, I think, was the first time I was like, holy crap. Like literally and figuratively. And I think my world opened up at that point. Like there's so much we can find with them if we trust them, because that had nothing to do with my capabilities and everything to do with hers. And if I had pre-assumed that I knew better and we just need to keep going and, you know, she was just who knows what, we could have left that discovery behind. And instead it became a really pivotal moment in my early career. And it's kind of been the theme, I'd say, of my work in this field is I'm paired with a dog I don't really want to work with. And then I end up having life altering experiences with them. And I could tell you more, but it's things like that where Max is always going to be the one, but every dog I've ever worked with has taught me something really incredibly special.
Mm. So what is your style in the field then? So when you're talking there, I was just thinking through that, because Heath and I, for example, are quite closely aligned in how we work, I believe, you know, and often that's quite different to the way a lot of other people work with their dogs and so on. So what is your style? I mean, because obviously you've got that alignment of philosophy and all that kind of stuff, but everyone has nuances. So what's yours?
It would be interesting if you talked to some of our other team members. I don't like to describe myself as this, but what I think of myself as is kind of the boring one. Like when I was at our previous program and we had a kennel of 20 plus dogs, you can imagine that's a very loud, high anxious environment. And I remember building up to where I could walk in and no one would make a peep. And it was like, oh, it's just Jennifer. Like, Jennifer doesn't equal fun. It doesn't equal high anxiety, high stress situations. I'm just very much like, I don't like to be around that energy. So I put that energy out there. And then like Heath said about Max, and I'd actually say it about most of the dogs I've worked with, there's a bit of cat in each of them where, I think maybe I'm attracted to the dogs that are a bit more solitary, independent, quiet ones. And even Scooby, my big black lab, who you'd think, and he was a lab through and through of like gooey, cute, sweet, goober, crazy, you know, and high energy. But when I worked with him, we almost went the exact same distance. Like if we looked at our track logs, like if I went 15 kilometers, Scooby might've gone 15 and a half. Whereas you put Scooby with another handler, he would almost go double. And some people might interpret that as like, oh, well, you want the dog to go further and farther. And that's so amazing. But the way I interpreted that and what I saw with Scooby in the field is like, we were a team and we went to places together and I wasn't overworking him and he didn't need to feel anxious about checking everywhere because he knew that he could trust me and I could trust him. And so it's almost like we were going through the landscape as a unit, if that makes sense. And we always came back with the same amount or equal, you know, data, which I put in quotes, that any of our other teams did. So I don't always think distance is, you know, of what the dog goes is the determining factor in the kind of the quality of the work that you do. So I guess my style is quiet and controlled and contained. And if a dog comes to me, that's very high energy. I don't want to dissipate that. I want them to have that energy and I want to support them having that in a constructive, safe way, if that makes sense. So then I channel it to the search. And I know that sounds kooky or crazy, but like with Filson, the dog I work with right now, he can be a very anxious dog. He can go off the wall nuts, barking, be crazy. But with me, everyone thinks he's just a calm pet dog. Like I've actually been asked, is he even working? Because I think he's able to take that anxiety that he has, that either is part of his disposition or just from, you know, the life he had before he came to us. And he's able to put it aside to focus on the work because maybe I support that or facilitate that for him, like give him that safe operating boundaries in order to do his work. And that's how I kind of like to think of it. But when I describe it to others, I'm like, I have the boring effect, but maybe it's more like a, you know, what are you going to say?
In tune effect. I mean, what Jennifer's describing is pretty common for our dogs. We have these outcasts that are off the wall and they are crazy. But when they go out with the right person, there's a switch that's flipped or whatever. And they kind of go into work mode. And so you may have this cattle dog that's looks like a pinball ball. Looks like a pinball, bouncing, you know, all over the place. And to somebody that doesn't know what's going on, that may look like, oh wow, they're really working. But you know, take that dog out with someone that knows what they're doing, and all of a sudden that dog is very controlled in where it's going, how it's searching, what it's doing, and it's a lot more manageable. And that's when it's really working. But to someone else, they're like, oh yeah, they seem pretty chill, like they're not that crazy.
Yeah, I thought you said these were high energy, crazy dogs. And I always have to explain why the dogs I work with, you know, might display a different kind of personality.
And Heath, would you say, well, I mean, is that Jennifer's best kind of quality in the field? So if you're using, yeah, when you're helping, when you're mentoring, training other handlers and so on, you know, what would you, you know, get them to watch Jennifer for, if you know what I mean? Well, what's she best at? Apart from making you look good.
Yeah. It's really, I mean, I guess one of the strong suits with Jennifer is we're very different in our personalities. And so it's a
polar
really
opposite.
It's a really good example of, I mean, I guess we're both introverted and quiet, but Jennifer is very meticulous and clean, I guess would be a good word, but she's very methodical about how she thinks, kind of like the way your dogs do. And so when you go out and you see each of his work, it can look very similarly, but from very different starting points. And it shows that, especially when you come to Rogues to learn how to do something, you're learning to work with the dogs as the person you are, not, you know, learning to work with the dogs like me or just like Jennifer. We're trying to take your own personality and help you reach that connection with the dog so you can both work together. And so Jennifer is a really great example of that because she'll go out with the dogs and like she says, it may not even look like they're working. Like people, you know, people will be like,
yeah, I don't make the best demo. I always say someone else should do the demo because people won't be wowed and awed. But if they watch someone else, I think they'll be super impressed. And that's not to say that the work, I'm not trying to throw the work that I do with the dogs under the bus. Like, I think the dogs I work with are absolutely incredible. So I hope I'm not making it sound like they're just duds. But what I mean by that is it just looks different. And I can go through an entire day in the field, for example, without talking. And some people's style is to talk a lot with their dog or have, you know, loud vocalizations, whether they're whistling them back or not. And like, for example, again, with Scooby, I remember this one time we saw a bear and I didn't want to alarm the bear. Like typically all you have to do is be like, "Hey bear," and they'll run away. But the act of running away, I didn't want to potentially panic that bear or have them stressed out. And so I just told, you know, with my body behavior, I stopped and told Scooby kind of the lay down, and he just laid down there. I think he eventually saw the bear, but he was like, "Okay, whatever. Just whenever you're ready, let me know." And we spent probably, you know, a good 10, 15 minutes with that bear until the bear moved away on its own. And we didn't have to be a factor in their daily life affecting them negatively. He could just, that bear, he or she could go about their life as opposed to having me interject my, you know, presence and the dog's presence, which might be a fearful thing. And so that's kind of what I mean about that, is just having a bit of that kind of quiet calm when I'm in the field.
When you watch somebody that's been doing this for a long time work a dog, it's very different than what you kind of want to watch somebody that's just learning to do.
True. That's a good point.
If they mimic what we're doing right now, that foundation for communication is not there. And the dog is like, "I don't know what you're doing, like, or what you want me to do or anything." But watching us work can be very boring and seem like, you know, if somebody watched, they'd be like, "Well, I could do that," because it doesn't really seem like we're doing anything. And that makes it extremely difficult when we're trying to teach folks, because you can't go out and work the way you'd normally do. You really have to kind of make things more obvious to people, because I kind of liken it to magic in that, you know, when you see a magic trick, you think it's just magic. Like, you know, there's some illusion or trick they did or whatever. But then you have to learn what's behind that magic for that to work that way. And when people get here, it's literally impossible for them to see the things the dog is doing that are very obvious to us, the things the dog's doing to communicate. And it just building on that and taking time can be really difficult. And so when Jennifer says she's boring, she's really not boring. Like, if somebody with more experience was watching, they would pick up on all that. But to a researcher coming out or new students or whatever, yeah, it's not it's not loud or you know, cheerleaders.
No, so sometimes you got to sell the sizzle. And with the demos, you do want the dog that's going, like, you want the Vegas version, don't you? You want the dog that's racing around, you know, going, here, you know. Mm-hmm. But actually, for somebody, and I agree with you, Heath, you know, somebody who knows what they're looking at, actually watching that kind of almost imperceptible quiet connection and, you know, and teamwork is a much more beautiful and impressive and awe-inspiring thing, you know, really, than the over-engine or the quite engineered dog that, you know, kind of gets around, for me anyway. One thing I wanted to touch on, though, just I was thinking when you were telling the bear story, you know, how, you know, you basically wanted to give, you know, the bear the time to kind of make their, you know, move off on their own way. You weren't kind of forcing your own agenda onto the natural world. Is that something that's kind of consciously important to you? Or is that just something that's part of you? And is that something you try and pass on to others when you're teaching, or is it a personal thing?
No, I love your questions. I think even though Max is obviously the reason I started in this field and ultimately what led me to want to stay, I don't think I would have stayed past the point where maybe I could have adopted Max and or Scooby and go on my merry way if it wasn't for the fact that this method is non-invasive. And that's incredibly important to me. One of the things that I guess that led me to this, like I said, with the spotted owls is we're passively collecting data on them. This is before the dogs. And so we never had to net them or collar them. And actually what I learned through the dogs is that even the act of calling them, which is the protocol, is in a way invasive because you're trying to elicit a response that normally wouldn't need to occur.
You're tricking a behavior out of them.
Yeah. You want, let's say it's a breeding pair and you want that male to say, like, okay, who's this other individual, I got to go protect my territory. You're calling them into that call point. What if there is a Cooper's hawk there, a goshawk, or a crow? And then when that male realizes there's not another owl there and we try to follow it to their nest, I mean, we're basically leading whatever else is listening into the forest back to their nest. And I'm not saying, I don't want to throw the protocol under the bus, like any biologist listening to this. I don't want to say that it's that happens all the time. Like, we wouldn't do that work if that was the case. It's more just on a personal level. I started realizing when I'm in the forest and how I interact with the environment, I have an effect regardless. Like, just the very act of being there is altering the daily habits of the wildlife I'm there either to research or just pass through their habitat. And I've also learned through the years that it's a huge concern with this method that researchers are very concerned about. They don't want to use this method because they think, you know, dogs are invasive. And so a lot of what Heath and I spend our time with is talking to various, you know, organizations about the method and how that's, if you're putting a team in the field that knows what they're doing and they've worked at that, then that's part of the method itself. Is we don't need to interact with the species. As much as I would love to see a bear, if I go through bear habitat without ever seeing one, that's a great day in the field because, you know, I'm not having any kind of effect, whether positive or negative. I'm just there collecting that data. And so, yeah, I think that's very important to me. And if I felt I was going into the environment and having any sort of negative kind of effect, I would really not want to do this work. I'd be very uncomfortable doing it. And so when new people come to our program, and I think they're very excited about the idea of, you know, working with a dog in nature, that just sounds really dreamy. And it's not that I want to curb their passion or their inspiration. But for me, what led me to this field is not that sort of romantic idea of being out in nature with my dog. It's that we can collect data on wildlife with this method in a manner that does not affect that wildlife. And I'm very much attracted to that side of this methodology. So it's very, I guess, critical to me, the ethics behind the method.
And were you always that way? I mean, with nature and the natural world and so on, I mean, growing up, was that something that was instilled in you by somebody else, or is that just the way you always were?
That's a good question. I am actually an English literature major by background. So I didn't study the sciences because I thought they were out of my reach or my realm. I was very quiet and shy, and math wasn't my strong suit. And anyone studying sciences, as you know, you need to do math. And then, sadly, I was deterred from science because of math. But I don't regret my degree path, though. I always was a bookworm. And I grew up in a household that kind of celebrated that. And I also grew up in a somewhat suburban environment, and was always, you know, this was pre-cell phones, pre-computer, was always encouraged to go outside and play. And so I just remember, you know, building small little forts with, you know, pebbles and twigs, and being like, this is, you know, where the woodland creatures live, and reading like the Redwall series and just quirky things like that, where I think my interaction with nature was very much like I developed it. I didn't have a mentor like my father. We didn't go on like, you know, camping trips into the rugged outdoors. My first time backpacking was studying abroad when I went to New Zealand, and I was like, oh my God, like, I didn't realize this was anyone could backpack. I thought, again, that was for explorers and adventurers. And I am not an explorer and adventurer. And so I think my way of interacting with nature, yes, was always kind of on this, like, I could have this little micro habitat and be in it all day and just, you know, play around. And so I guess expanding that to my work now, I guess that's how I still like to go about it. Like, I'm only there temporarily, and we have a really important job to do. And I'm very task driven, and just going out there to do what we're there to do, I guess. It kind of sounds a little dull and boring. Again, like I said, it doesn't sound very inspiring, but
It doesn't sound dull and boring to me at all. I think it sounds very inspiring. I may be completely off the mark, but I mean, I'm right in saying you've got Native American heritage. Am I right about that?
I do. On my grandmother's side, she was an enrolled member of the Lakota Sioux tribe. But
so does that, I mean, do you feel some kind of connection to the land, you know, type? I don't know anything about this, as you can tell, you know, but
I don't know. I think that's a good question to ask, but I wasn't raised with on Native territory. While I met our relatives and I've visited the reservation, I never grew up around, you know, Lakota Sioux people. So I can't say that my experience mimics any of theirs. Mm. I think we would need to talk to Native persons to ask about their relation. I do remember once, because my mother has long worked with Native Americans throughout her career as a Indian child welfare attorney and being in-house lawyer for like Mashantucket Pequots and working for Native American Rights Fund, which is a nonprofit organization here in the United States. So anyways, through her work, sometimes I traveled to different places. And I remember being in this Pueblo community and having dinner with these folks. And I told them about my work with owls. And all of a sudden they got really upset. Like, oh, owls are, you know, did you know that they are kind of harbingers of evil and bad luck? And I was like, oh, here I thought, like, you know, look at me. I work with owls and I just love it. And it's just so special. And they were like, that's absolutely the worst thing I've ever heard. So, I can't say for certain that my relationship is anything like, their relationship with the outdoors, but, it is important to me. Like, I think as our work in Rogues gets more busy, I find myself doing more office work, and that's absolutely not my passion or my inspiration. And I need to be in the field. It like fuels my energy, my imagination, and my passion. So, whatever that means.
Yeah, but of course you can't leave the office work to Heath. I mean, the whole thing will fall in a shit show of a heap if you leave that all to Heath.
Yeah. Actually, fun side story. I do remember, again, back with the program we used to be with, we didn't have anyone managing communications. It was just a scrappy program, just like ours. And I remember one day, I don't know how it happened, but I think I was helping Heath with something, and I looked at his inbox and it said like over 2,000 unread emails. And I'm like, oh my, like my, you know, kind of English literature and very task oriented side was just like, oh my God, you can't not answer these emails. So I asked if I could answer them, and he's like, go for it. But these are spanning like 5-10 years. And I'm like, that's okay. And I literally went through every single one and answered them. And some were from people who wanted to get into the field. And by the time I was writing them, some wrote back and they were like, yeah, I kind of already finished my PhD, but thanks so much for getting back to me finally. And if anyways, I tell that story just because I think that's in a roundabout way how I unfortunately ended up in the position I am in now, which is, managing our communications as Rogues. So silly me, I slapped myself on the wrist. I've learned my lesson.
although I mean, it is a role to be celebrated. I mean, honestly, you know, you guys have got by far the best kind of communication education outreach, you know, like offerings in the industry in what you put out there, and I know that he's not doing that, so I mean, you know, You should be lauded for what you do there.
I really wanted to be anonymous about it. So, and Heath has unfortunately made it public that I'm the one behind a lot of our social media. And so it's quite embarrassing because I just want it to be the every person. But
that basically means I get in trouble every time I tell people what an amazing job she's doing.
But what I do want to say about social media, because I know it's kind of the dreaded, everyone hates it. And it's not to say that I love it either, but what I noticed when we launched Rogues is we were unknown. We were starting over from scratch. We couldn't tell the world who we used to be and who we are now. And when we had started social media as our other program, honestly, it was just literally, putting up pictures of dogs with like no information, just, you know, cause that was the early days of social media too. And we're just like, we have so many photos to share. Where are these going to go? So it was just like a depository for that. But then it grew into something. And as the method grew, you know, more people started asking questions. And I think when we started Rogues, I realized like, I felt the sense of responsibility, I guess, to put information out there if it was the least we could contribute to. Because at that time, we didn't even know if we were going to get projects. We didn't know if we were going to be a program. We just wanted to help if we could, you know, the few projects that we were still invested in. And so if it was our tiny bit of our mini legacy as we kind of said goodbye to the detection dog world, I was like, well, I'll just do what I can until we fade, you know, slowly into the sunset. And I think it's kind of become a beast because I realize that there's so much to share. There's so many incredible people and dogs doing so much incredible work. And like I said, most of our work is never published. And so no one will see that. And I imagine that's the same for a lot of other people in this field. And their work is very important to them, and their dogs are very special to them. So we're not unique, obviously, in that. And if we can use our platform to elevate others, that brings me joy, because we never had that. You know, no one ever supported or kind of celebrated us. It kind of had to kind of be us patting ourselves on the back. And I know how hard that is to just be starting out in this field. And I just wanted to be able to give a little bit back from when we transitioned over, all the kind of quiet support that we received from the community we had built up, mostly Heath, over the years when we were our previous program. So just started, it wasn't supposed to become what it is, but it's nice to hear that it's having that effect. It makes me realize, okay, well, maybe it's not stupid all the time I spend trying to, you know, reach out to people and share their stories.
No, it's really not. And from my perspective, I think there's two things that you get very right here. And the first thing is that you understand that, you know, the content needs to be valuable, you know, to people. Yeah, you can't just put out, you know, just anything just to create noise, you know, so you have to be engaging. Even when you are talking about what you're doing, it doesn't come across as blowing your own, you know, horn a little bit. It comes across as you're celebrating the work of the dog, or you're celebrating the conservation outcome or stuff like that. And so that's great. But then also you spend a lot of time engaging with others on their outputs as well, which is really valuable. So that's the first thing that I think you do brilliantly. The other thing is just the style, just the way, you know, maybe this is the English lit background, I don't know, but the style and the way in which you write and, you know, and the posts and just the, yeah, Heath and I have spoken about this before, yeah, how important words are, the choice of the right word, and, you know, and you do choose those words, you know, very, very well. So, you know, I mean, you know, I'm a 50-year-old man. Social media to me is horrendous, but I always look at your stuff because it's interesting, and yeah, because it's interesting to me, and I like to read it, and you know, and that's kind of the acid test.
Well, I think Heath is selling himself short here, though. Words are important.
Don't praise him. Don't praise.
Well,
him.
No, I've learned through him, though. The voice that you talk about is not. Mine alone. It's very much like, especially when we were feeling very insecure, or me maybe, about starting new and being, you know, that's just daunting. But always when we were putting information out, Heath is like, we're not, you know, saying that we're this amazing, world renowned, best, whatever, because that, none of that matters. What matters is what we're doing now. And we don't know those things. Like, we can say it, but we don't know it. And so the best we can do is to put our best paw forward, to throw a pun in there. And I like that, because I'm still getting lessons and mentorship from Heath all these years later, that, you know, I realize I have an ego, and putting that ego kind of to the sidelines has helped me process and heal from maybe some of the, I don't want to call it trauma, but scary parts of starting Rogues. And had we gone a different direction, you know, who knows if we would be where we are now. And I think that's always stood out to me in how Heath engages with the people who reach out to us to work with us, is creating that partnership and relationship, and always mentioning that, you know, we're not the only, and now there are so many others, and we should be celebrating the fact that this field is growing, not trying to be like, choose Rogues. You know, there's more work than we can. Sure, there's not enough work, but there's more work than we can do. And so I can't take credit for that. And yeah, I just wanted to make sure that everyone knew that wasn't. And I have him look at a lot of the things I put out before I put out, because I think having second eyes on things is important. Mm. So we're definitely a team.
Good.
She works extremely hard on it, though. And it's where we live, our internet is not the best. And so she can be working on a post for hours and then lose it all. And then just do it again. It's amazing.
Well, the dogs, otherwise no one knows what the dogs are doing. And we got a lot of great dogs on our team. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect segue into my next question then, because what I wanted to go was just double back onto something we were talking about before, and that was what the dogs have taught you. So what I'd like you to do, if you're able to, is tell us a few stories of some different dogs and the things that they've taught you.
Well, I have my go-to stories because they've just been so special to me. So I'll focus on... Well, I definitely want to tell a story about Scooby, but I'll try to just tell these other two really quick. I, like I said, never wanted to work with other dogs other than Max. And then I didn't want to work with Scooby, but I fell in love with him. And that's a whole other story. But then I had Scooby. So, you know, I'm set, right? I don't want to work with any more dogs. But nope. You know, we had this dog who was experiencing some issues in the field. And as the veteran handler in the program at the time, he was like, it's kind of your responsibility. I want you to take this dog under your wing. I'm like, I don't want to work with Winnie. Like, come on, she's insane. And I've just gotten to the point where Scooby is just this brilliant dog in the field. And we have such a good relationship, but in many ways he needed to go teach others because, he was finally at a stage that, immature that, we could give him to other handlers to kind of boost their confidence, if that makes sense. Give them a dog that will help give them the spirit to think like, okay, I can do this. And Scooby, that was his gift. So then that then meant I had to work with Winnie. And she at the time was just running around amok, just insane. She would like nose the samples. So she'd like flip him in the air and be like, oh, is this what you want? And we knew that she had potential, but her ball drive was very different than our other dogs. So I went on this project and looking for Fisher Scat. And I remember, I don't know how it happened, but just telling Heath, like, this isn't working. She doesn't have ball drive. She doesn't know the game. And Heath is like, you need to start back at square one. Like, and I know you know how to do this. Like, he kept telling me, like, you can do this. And I kept, like, pushing back, like, no, this dog doesn't work. And it was my own kind of my decision making and ego that got in the way. And eventually he had to come out. We were having other challenges on this project, so he came out and kind of shadowed me in the field. And I remember this one moment with Winnie where like I said, I'm very, like, you know, organized and task oriented. And it's like, we're going to go out here and we're going to survey for wildlife. And so that's what we're going to do. And, you know, Winnie should already know X plus Y equals, you know, well, X plus B equals C. And rather than being the coach that she needed. And Heath went out there and set out a few samples and just started rewarding her. Just went, like, just wanted to make it the most fun thing she had ever done in her life. And I mean, 10 minutes later, he was still playing. 15 minutes later, he was still playing. And we're talking like Winnie is now like slathering at the mouth. She's like breathing heavy. She's like, oh my God, this is so awesome. But she's obviously like getting tired. I was like, Heath, we still have the whole survey left to go. Like, what are you doing? And he's like, there's no point in surveying if she doesn't have joy, if she doesn't know what she's doing, if she doesn't know what she's supposed to be doing. And this is how I'm sharing that to her. So I definitely had a lesson that day. And like, it doesn't have to look like what you think it's supposed to look like. And I should have known that already with having worked with Max and Scooby. But I loved that lesson because, and I'll try to make this fast, but I was gearing up to go to Africa and we didn't want anything to happen to the dog I was taking beforehand, which was Scooby. And, you know, we needed everything to be, you know, hunky-dory status quo for his health check and everything. And we got this project to go look for wolverines in North Cascades National Park. And I remember him asking me, like, what dog do you want to take? So finally I got to choose, right? He's like, you can take Scooby, but what dog do you want to take? And I was like, I want to take Winnie. And it was her first backpacking trip. It was her first time on a boat, her first time in a hammock. I mean, we're talking a lot of firsts. And why would you take a dog in a very, very critical, like, project. It was just supposed to be a few days to try to help find what had happened to this Wolverine. And they had tried everything else, like sent in helicopters and had a whole bunch of human teams. And like, we were the last-ditch effort. So it's like, you don't want to like mess this up because that would look really poor for the method. But I was like, Winnie's got it. And sure enough, we were out there. And of course, the researchers are like, oh man, I thought we would have found something by now. And that puts a lot of pressure on the handler. And you start to get really nervous and like, oh good. And she found this bear skull, which was really, really cool. So at least it could be like, oh yeah, look, she found this. Isn't that cool? And so while the biologists are kind of focused on the bear skull and being like, oh, this is cool, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go the steepest place I can, because that's what I know about Wolverine behavior. And we're in the cluster points of where this Wolverine was last seen. So we'll all just go explore. And I kind of left them behind. And I went up with Winnie. And I remember she's so goofy. She's very expressive. And we're climbing. Like, I'm literally hand over feet on tree limbs. It's kind of like scaling rock cliff. And I'm pushing her up, her butt up with my hand till she gets to this like lip of this little kind of cliff. And she sniffs something and then she like looks around at me and her eyes are big, like bugs, like, oh my gosh. And I'm like, I'm not there yet. Wait. But my heart started beating really fast. And I climb up over this lip and I think she was in as much shock as me because there was these poops there. But I kind of know what Wolverine Scat looks like from the textbooks, but of course nothing ever looks like the textbook. And I'm looking at this thing and it's hairy and twisty. It's really long, but it's got a whole bunch of bear fur in it. And I was like, Winnie, this is totally it. We totally found it. And what I love about this story is that I didn't know necessarily what I was doing looking for Wolverines, just what I had read in a book. And Winnie was the one that found that. And if I hadn't given her that opportunity to teach me and trust her and learned what she had kind of taught me, you know, observing her working with Heath, I never would have believed in her. And she actually helped solve a mystery that no one else could, that they had spent, you know, thousands of dollars trying to figure out, is this the first Wolverine den in Washington? And what we had discovered, or what Winnie discovered, is that no, this Wolverine kept returning to this area, feeding on a bear. And so that bear skull that she found originally down below that I had thought nothing to do with the Wolverine was just one clue that eventually led to this kind of discovery that this Wolverine had come back to this area to feed on this bear. And so I just thought that was like tangible in the moment, you know, it didn't have to go through a big long publication process to be like, we figured out what's going on. And I wouldn't have done that without Winnie. Like, there's no way I would have found that scat. I could have climbed that cliff like everyone else did and not found anything. And Winnie led me to that. And so anyways, there's more stories, but I kind of, that one took a lot longer than I thought. So I don't want to take more time. But she's a special girl in my heart too.
That's great. Don't worry about time. We've got plenty of time. Heath. Yeah. What questions should we be asking Jennifer publicly?
Oh man, put me on the spot. I always think a good question these days is where things are headed, and Jennifer and I talk about this constantly, but just how things have changed in the last 5 years. But that's a tough question. So I don't know if I should open that can of worms.
Well, I think you already have. Go on then, Jennifer.
Oh man. I'll be honest. I think I'm like too far in this method and this field to have a really objective standpoint. And like we talked about with social media, want to have a positive kind of voice, because there's just a lot of sadness and heaviness happening in the world, around the world. And so I never want to be another source of like, you know, woe is this. But internally, and since you asked, I do have a lot of trepidation for where the field is heading. And I think in many cases, it's because of the lessons I've learned from the dogs that I've worked with And I want, I, my hope is that, you know, others everywhere are having these same discoveries with their dogs and alongside their dogs. But where I see this field kind of going, it's going in a different way. And maybe I don't know enough about dog training and other parts of this field, but it's what I'm seeing is a whole lot of trying to program dogs and make kind of a robot that can work, you know, either just on one species or always the same way. And as folks may or may not know about Rogues, we work with multiple species simultaneously. And while obviously the alert's very important, we don't, the handler is very much a part of that relationship. And too often, both of what I'm seeing out there as well as internally when we bring people in is people just want a manual. They want to know how. They don't want to spend the time to really learn that dog and problem shoot. And I am the first guilty person to be like, sure, I didn't want to either. I mean, I just shared an entire hour of how I didn't want to work Scooby. I didn't want to work with Winnie. I didn't want to work with all these dogs. And then what I learned through them was just firmly like taught me to believe in everything that this method can be. And I'm really interested in seeing this method be applied more. And I think what I'm seeing is a lot of it still in the testing phase. And I get that that's important as it moves to different countries or communities. People have skepticism and they might need a proof of concept project, but I'd rather that not be the entire effort. And then it takes time to publish that. And then you never actually see a team out there bringing in data or information on that species. And I think my other fear is that while detection teams have such a great ability to find elusive and rare species, and that is a big strength of the method, there's other ways to deploy the method. And it could be, you know, finding more common species to tell us about what's happening in that habitat for rare and endangered, or maybe getting baseline data on a species that is common right now, but we don't know in 10 years if it will be. And a good example is we worked in Cambodia for tiger work, and they also wanted us to find leopard, but no one ever did anything with that leopard data. And I think it was eventually thrown out. And I saw a news article a year or two ago about, you know, Cambodia's leopards are just declining at such a rapid rate and no one knows what's happening. And I'm like, we were there 15 years ago and there should be a database for someone to delve into that data. And I guess I just hope that this method, I want it to help. I don't want it to always to be in this, like, look at this next amazing thing that dogs can do. I want it to kind of be layered in as, you know, something that's actually providing, you know, information, I guess. I know that's a weak end to that kind of tirade, but I guess that's where I am. Just a bit concerned with what I'm seeing and not really sure how to address it appropriately in the community at large.
Yeah, there seems to be a couple of things there in what you said, so I had to kind of unpack them separately, I guess. There's an element there, if I was hearing you right, of the sort of projects, the scope of the projects that the dogs are being used for. So they're being accepted more in certain areas, but they're perhaps becoming a little bit pigeonholed in terms of, you know, what they're used to do rather than being used more creatively in terms of the capabilities they could do and the work, you know, or the objectives of the work, you know, the scope of the work that is being done. And there's also that element of, and this is something I go on tirades about as well. Everyone who knows me knows I do. It's, you know, as the industry, if we can call it that yet, you know, becomes more established, then more people enter it from different fields that may have experience with dogs, but they may come from other detection disciplines or, you know, I mean, other professional dog, you know, areas. But a lot of that, they come in with It is the little robots bit. It's the contrived control, you know, type stuff. And that probably goes to, and there'll be, I'll get a lot of, you know, kickback on this, but it probably goes to what you were saying before about, you know, what Heath was saying when you're out with Winnie, that, you know, there's no point doing the survey if she's not finding the joy in it, you know? And there'll be a lot of people out there that would say, oh, well, you know, even me working my dog, you know, instructing my dog, directing my dog, you know, running my dog, you know, my dog has joy in that. And I know that a lot of dogs would, you know, just, mm-hmm. you know, it's just I'm not, yeah. just to try and kind of head off some of that kickback I'll get. But, you know, but going to the ethos of where I know you guys are about and certainly where I'm about as well, it's, you know, I agree entirely, you know, that, you know, the work's there to be enjoyed, you know, and but yeah, you know, also to add as much value as it can do. So is that kind of what you were getting at?
Yeah.
Have I kind of encapsulated it?
Yeah, not forcing a dog who may not have the drive or doesn't really want to do this to do it. Finding those dogs that really want to do it and kind of tapping into their unique way of doing it. I mean, Max easily would have failed. Filson would have failed. Scooby, no one could work him, and he wouldn't have been deployable if not for literally being up at, you know, nearly midnight every other night with him, trying to figure out ways to get him to bridge his distrust from wherever he had come from before and whoever he had worked with before, to be like, no, we can be a team together. But that takes so much time, and not all of it can be paid time. I mean, that's what I think the hard part about this work is, forcing it into a kind of a job structure already diminishes some of what the discoveries we can have. And I know that when people come with their personal dogs, they're a little bit more incentivized to work with them one-on-one, but that dog may or may not want to do it. And that person may or may not have the skills necessary. So it's kind of how do we teach people and dogs as this field kind of morphs into different things, because I don't want to make cookie cutters of myself in my relationship with Max. Like that's not my goal. And nor is it to turn away people who want to do this. Cause I obviously came into this field in a very roundabout way, you know? So I'm the first person to say that you can come from a diverse background to be a detection dog handler. But I guess it's how to best share that this field takes so much work, so much effort, so much personal investment, and you're not going to see a return immediately. And it may mean that you're not going on super sexy projects for a couple years. It may mean that the dog that you really, really want to work with that is not suitable, and that we as the individuals going into this field have a responsibility to recognize that. And I think one of the best examples I can have of this is a researcher we worked with many years ago, was like a master student and was doing work and wanted to be the dog handler. And we were trying to get away of having master students or PhD students being the dog handler and having professional detection dog handlers, precisely because being a master student and a PhD student is a full-time job in and of itself. So then how do you add on top of that caring for the dog, and especially dogs with special needs? I mean, all of our dogs, and I would imagine others in this field would say the same, to do this work, they're a little bit extra, you know? And so they're going to need extra care. And if you're not able to put that time in, then we don't really have a business putting teams out there, because it's not going to do the methodology well. It's not fair to the wildlife. And one of the things that she said years later was just that at the time that was really frustrating to hear. You know, no one wants to be told no, or you can't do this, or you shouldn't. And not that that's what we were saying, but she realized later in retrospect that yes, she shouldn't have been doing that. And I think that was the first kind of acknowledgement we had ever had, because we aren't kind of seen as, for lack of a better word, experts, you know, because neither Heath or I have our PhDs. I was going to go get my master's and hopefully PhD in spotted owls. But like I said, I met Max and my life took a different route. And many people actually that we've worked with, at least in our program, have left our program to pursue a master's and a PhD precisely because the two aren't necessarily compatible at the same time. That doesn't mean that they can't utilize detection dogs in their research. I just mean that this field takes a lot. And when we share that, people think we're putting up barriers. Like when people have, I remember that's why we like to actually hire people who are in a relationship or married, precisely because, I mean, if both of them can do it and want to do it, is because this field takes you to some really extreme places and you're often working alone or just with another bounder. And if they can have that support system, otherwise having a relationship in this field is incredibly challenging. And I feel like people want to point a finger or put blame on why this field is so challenging. And typically that falls back, I think, on the programs themselves. Like, we don't have it all figured out. It might look shiny from the outside because we're trying to put a lot of information out there. And I don't know if this is how other detection dog programs feel, so I can only speak for ourselves. But sure, we want to put our best foot forward, but it doesn't mean we have it all figured out. And there's definitely a lot of challenges to this field that I don't know how to appropriately communicate with persons trying to enter this field without kind of ruffling a whole lot of feathers and, you know, people just getting really angry, I guess.
I think it is quite hard. I think, and I never quite, I always struggle to work out what, you know, where I fall on the side of this kind of argument or this concept. But if you look at kind of the ethos, the philosophy, the style, the feel that you guys at Rogue, you know, operate with, and it's encapsulated perfectly by that thing we were talking about before with Winnie, you know, that, you know, there's no point doing the survey if she's not, you know, finding the joy in it. That's a rarity, I think, in the world. I think there's more of that in the conservation dog world at the moment, you know, which is good, than there are in certainly in other dog disciplines, but it's certainly a rarity. Do you yourselves, I mean, obviously it's the right way for you. Do you guys feel that's the way that it should be broadly done? Because what I'm getting at is there's a lot of people, you know, with a lot of experience with dogs. Yeah, they are proper dog trainers. I know you guys don't consider yourself dog trainers, you know, neither do I. You know, but there's a lot of people that are dog trainers. They've got some fantastic technical skills. You know, they can teach and motivate a dog to do almost anything, you know. So there could be a lot of people working in this field with that style. Is that wrong? Like, should people be doing it the Rogue James way, or
no? I think that's a great question, and no, short answer, no. Again, our way isn't the only way. It's a way I know how, and I know that it works, which is why I can only talk about my experiences. But sadly, I think when I read papers that might share that the detection dog method doesn't work, and I read into why. Sometimes it's like the dog wasn't motivated, or the dog was bored, or peed on samples, or ate samples, or rolled on samples. And I'm like, either that to me tells me, you know, one of several things. Either that dog just isn't motivated to do the work, so why are we kind of forcing them to do this job? Or two, the handler hasn't tapped into how to work with that dog, because that's a sign to me, at least, of frustration in a dog. Like, if we have a dog here, because that's, you know, it happens. If they're not, you know, during a controlled training exercise, they're expressing that. That to me is like, I need to step back. I mean, that's a lesson Winnie gave me, is like, I can't just expect this dog to do this because, you know, we taught them the basics and they should just know better. It's realizing that every different scenario that we work with them in is basically starting from square one. Like, I can't take anything for granted. And that's not to say, like you said, that there are these amazing people out there who can work with animals, be these dogs or rats or horses. Like, I know there's some incredible people just teaching, or and not even teaching, because I think it's a feedback. It's the animal teaching as well as the human teaching. And maybe they're just more capable of hearing what it is that animal saying, and then giving them back what it is, you know, they're hoping to, the end result's going to be. And that's why I say I'm not a dog trainer, because I know how to do this one thing and I know how to do it very well. But even if you put me with a new dog, it's going to take me just as much time with that new dog to put in that effort. Like, it's not just a given. And maybe with some people, it is like putting a glove on and going out. And that, what I mean by that analogy is it's just like, it fits. Not that you have to wear gloves when you work dogs. I think that's also why I want to engage with other detection dog programs, is I don't know how it looks for other people. I see, you know, a lot of people though come to us sharing, like, I've been being told this, this, and this, and it's not working for me. And I feel like there's got to be another way. And I somehow, we, you know, somehow found out about you guys. And that's how a lot of our conversations start. And a lot of our relationships with some of the people that we know with and respect around the world is they're looking for a different way. And so I never thought of us as different. I actually thought of us as like, this is how you do it, because there was only, you know, two or three detection dog programs at the time operating, at least in the United States. So, and we all started from the same kernel. So in my brain, it was like, this is how you do it. But you know, if we stop ourselves there, then we're never opening ourselves to new things or being open to learning different lessons from the dogs. So I guess that was a really complicated answer, because I'm saying yes and no. I'm saying I like what we do because I know it works and I'm comfortable in it, but that doesn't mean that I only want to do what we do and that there isn't another way. And I'm interested in learning how other people work too, but that's scary too, being observed by other people. I don't want to go in the field with other people because, like I said, I don't think I make the method look real snazzy and snappy. And so I get really shy, and that might affect the way I work too. So it's just, it's a very convoluted, tricky question to answer, you know?
Yeah, well, I tend to specialize in that. But I think, I mean, going to what you were just saying there about going out in the field, I mean, I think if you get the right people, you know, out in the field, and, you know, as Heath was saying before, you know, like if you know enough, then you can watch you work and you can see the value, you know, or the value or the complexity or the, you know, whatever in that. It doesn't need to be the Vegas version, and arguably it's more the non-Vegas version is more, I don't know, the Missouri version. Upset anyone in Missouri. The only reason I pick on Missouri is because my brother lives there. So just cover, nice. Cover that you off for anyone who's living in Missouri. It just popped into my head. Shit. Lost all those listeners in Missouri now. Fuck. Anyway. But yeah, it's the, you know, there's often, you know, a lot more in the less flashy, you know, than in the flashy. So before I put my foot in my mouth any further and choke on it, what's next for you guys? So you're living in your little winter wonderland. Anyone who follows you on social media has seen Heath trudging through the snow, you know, with the dogs and that kind of thing. Oh, incidentally, the dogs are on a lead, I noticed. Why was that in the pictures?
Well, when we get closer to our main road, one of our dogs, Beckett, he's actually the most lovey dogs that we have. But if he doesn't know you, he's actually our most dangerous dog. And so the closer we get to our main road, because if anyone knows this post, it's we were checking the mail. And so we just put him on for safety because we never want to put Beckett in a situation that he will have to express himself out of fear. So,
yeah.
Just that, it
occurred to me.
Yeah, came back. They were off leash and having fun. What's next?
What are you guys doing? What are you up to?
I think we want hopefully, to rest.
Yeah, hopefully sleeping.
He wants the power to go out. But we're looking at possibly having some winter field work in the new year. And we're getting. You know, this is a time of year when we have a lot of phone calls and meetings with people to plan for next year. So it's like every day we've had one or two meetings. And then on top of that, you know, Heath's car died. So we had to go buy a new car. all the things that kind of get pushed aside, you know, we're doing all of our doctor appointments now with dentist appointments. It's crazy. But we're just trying to catch up on life, I think. But hopefully find some time to just enjoy being with the dogs too, without, you know, being on a project.
Yeah. How many have you got at home at the moment? How many are there?
We have 11. 10 or 11.
11.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You lost one?
one of them
might sound crazy that we don't know.
But one of them is hopefully being adopted this coming up weekend. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
Yeah. So we never, again, I was talking to someone recently about like our program's operations, and she's like, but it says on your website this, but then I'm hearing you say this. And I'm like, well, it's never set in stone. And so we have our core dogs, the ones that live in the yurt. I think we have seven.
Six.
And but then we have our other pack, and they're over at the main house, and we have another couple of folks over there helping to take care of them in the off season. And then we've had a bunch adopted out this year to the bounders that we hired. And so that brought us a lot of joy too. So we may or may not adopt more dogs this year if we keep our operations small. So we just have to see. It's always a question mark. But keeps us busy no matter what, you know, 10 dogs is still a lot.
Yep. But not a bad thing.
No. And they're all great. And we bought a new, we call it Purple Ball, but I guess it's called a Jolly Ball. And we built a fenced in yard because we're trying to create our facility to be a little bit more friendly for people of different abilities in their levels of working with dogs. So we realized we can't just expect everyone to, yeah, this dog's great off leash. That might be with us, but it might take extra time. So we want to, if we are going to host classes, we're actually building some kennels and a backyard, fenced in backyard, so we can facilitate a little bit more potential classwork in the future and dog safety parameters. So just things like that. We chip away at it here and there.
That's great. Heath, before we finish up, you've been uncharacteristically quiet. Have you had anything anything you wanted to mention or say?
Nope.
Nope.
I'm not being uncharacteristically quiet. This is the normally. You, whenever I'm around you, I end up talking more. I was just trying to stay in the background, and I was here for emotional support. And no, I'm looking forward to sleeping soon. Yeah, anything I would want to talk about would be a whole nother podcast, I
think. Yeah. Well, let's organize that for the new year. We'll do another. There's always so much to talk about.
Yeah, I liked what you did last year. I think it was for New Year's.
The Christmas special.
Yeah.
I really should pull my finger out and see if I can schedule that again this year. I don't know whether I'll be able to or not because I've left it late. My organization is kind of on a par with Heath's, just so you know, Jennifer. So
I just want to ask more questions about you, but you're so good at asking questions. So.
Yeah, we should talk about your new recruit. You've got
my new recruit. Yes.
In the ring there.
He's No, it's actually in the interest of sort of longevity of the episode. So I recently got a new puppy, a Australian catalogue puppy, partially inspired by your guys' love of the breed. I mean, I've always loved the breed as well, but being a spaniel guy, I've always just kind of gone, just get spaniels. But it kind of inspired me to step out of my comfort zone a little bit, actually. And I'm finding that quite interesting in that, you know, just the personality differences that you get with the different breeds and that kind of thing. Yeah. So he's a lovely little boy, but he's different mm-hmm. to a spaniel puppy, for example. You know, like one thing I was thinking about this morning is he likes a cuddle if he wants a cuddle, you know. So if you want to kind of pick him up and give a cuddle, he'll bite your face off, you know, if he's not in the mood for it. But he always wants to be with you. So he's always next to me, you know, and always between my feet and wherever. And if he's nice and sleepy, and he might crawl up and, you know, and have a cuddle if he's in the mood. But if you try and, you know, put yourself onto him, he's like, nah.
And well, that was a great description.
Yeah, that's a cat dog.
So I was, I'm quite enjoying that journey, really, and just seeing those kind of breed specific, you know, type factors that I may not be. I mean, obviously I've worked with lots of them, but not, I haven't raised one myself. So it's he's actually teaching me quite a lot already, which is really, really nice. Yeah, for me.
Yeah.
Because you can get a little bit blasé. I mean, obviously you get, you know, the spaniels are, I mean, obviously you get different personalities, different challenges, but yeah, you know, if you've worked with enough of them, you kind of go into it with a bit of a, you know, this is all I need to do and it'll all be good. And most of the time that works out fine. So yeah, having something that desperately wants to, like the Velociraptor comes out quite regularly with Blue, and I'm like, oh shit, you know.
Oh, I love that description. Yeah. And I think that's what I love about working with different breeds too. A lot of people want to ask us about breeds, and I'm the first to admit, I don't know a lot of different breeds and their personalities. I am predispositioned to healers because of Max, but my first introduction to healers was actually an aunt had a dog, a healer, and he was awful. And he was so mean and he was so rude and he stole food off the counter and he growled at anyone. You couldn't sit on the couch. I was just like, ooh, this dog's awful. So I never thought I would choose a blue healer for myself. And I didn't. It was really Max who opened up my eyes to their special, unique personalities. And I'm not a lab dog. And Scooby made me realize, like, I have a huge, my other half is, you know, I'm pointy ear club some of the time and I'm floppy ear club the other half, because Scooby has had a heart of gold and I've never met another dog like him. And I can't recreate either of them. I don't want to, but at the same time, I now have way more respect for labs than before I worked with them, where I just like kind of wrote them off as like crazy and rambunctious and uncontrollable, you know, all the things that we say about our dogs anyways. But, I think I love that about Scooby. So I'm glad to hear that, your little puppy is sharing some of the special sides of healer care.
Yeah, definitely the special sides. Yeah, when my hands and arms eventually heal, I'll be fine. All right, guys. Look, this has been a great episode. I've loved just having the chance to talk to you. I mean, obviously, Jennifer, we've spoken before, but it's nice to be able to sort of speak publicly and try and, you know, share with the world what an amazing person you are. So that's been really great to do so. And we'll try and get the Christmas episode sorted out. If we can't, it might be a bit of a New Year episode at this late stage, but we'll see what we can work out with people's availability. But if I don't speak to you before, hope you both have a great Christmas. I hope all your Christmas wishes come true. Heath, I hope the power goes out for you. And thanks very much for taking the time as ever. And have a good one. Take care.
Thank you James. So much. This is awesome.
Wonderful to see you.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Conservation Canine Podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please like, share, and subscribe wherever you find us.